Hi, this is Bill Arnold. Missed a show or need me talking to help you sleep tonight? I have several solutions to that situation. Here are the podcasts from the show. You are the best for listening and supporting Faith Radio. And a warm welcome to Afternoons with Bill Arnold. Thank you for joining me today. I am always looking forward to our time together. And today's no exception, by the way. And it's Friday, so I'm pretty comfortable with that idea. I like the idea of Friday. It's apparently there are roughly four a month. And I have a tendency of liking them. I love Mondays, but I really like Fridays too, because it's nice to be able to have a weekend ahead for a little R&R. I don't know what your plans are. I hope you get some time to get some productivity in. Maybe a little spring cleaning, or is that premature? Let me know. And then also that you get time to be with friends and family and maybe a little extra time in bed in the morning where you can sleep in just a little bit. Always feels good. In Psalm 145, it says, "The Lord is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and rich in love." I love that that's how he works with us, that he's gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, rich in love. You must know people in your life who are not slow to anger and maybe are a little skimpy in love. And that's not our Lord. Our Lord is gracious and compassionate. That's Psalm 145, verse 8. Today, I've got on the program Angela Schultes. She is the Vice President of Outreach at Treehouse, and Treehouse is an amazing place. If you have teens that are facing issues like depression and suicide or self-harm and substance abuse, bullying, and even sex and dating issues, when kids are on the fringe and they have nowhere to go and they end up lost and they end up at Treehouse, they're going to get some amazing counseling and fellowship and community. It's been around since the late 70s, and I'm going to give Angela to give us an update on what's going on in the lives of so many young kids who are facing so many tough issues, some of which are things as simple as intense loneliness, which I can't even imagine. Because when I grew up, and my friends, we connected and were together all the time. And we just had such a great time as being friends and hanging out and doing everything together. We were never lonely. We had each other. But it seems that in this day and age, there's obviously more relationships that are not real. They're online and they're not satisfying. I mean, we're analog beings living in a digital world, and we still need eye contact and arms around each other and a shoulder to cry on. So I'm going to take a little break, and then Angela's going to be joining me in about 60 seconds.
Hi, I'm Neil Stavem, manager of Faith Radio. You know, we're always so encouraged and humbled when we hear from listeners whose lives have been changed by what they've heard on our station. Here's a listener who said, "Thank you, Faith Radio, for changing my life. I've always believed I was a Christian, yet I didn't have a good understanding of what it meant to have a personal relationship with Christ. Over listening to your station, I'm happy to say that I now have what I have always longed for, but didn't know, and that is Jesus in my daily life. I truly feel transformed." You know, when God's word is proclaimed, lives are changed, and we are honored to have the privilege of delivering the good news of the gospel day by day, thanks to your prayer and financial partnership in this ministry. And for those of you who've given to keep this message of God's love available on the air, online, and on the app, we say thank you. And if you've yet to get involved, know that our spring fundraiser begins April 9th. Or better yet, you can make a gift anytime online at myfaithradio.com. Thanks.
The vision of Treehouse is to reach every at-risk teen so they are loved, they feel hope, and they realize life transformation. To accomplish this vision, they seek to bring living hope to hurting youth and families, leading to life transformation. That's the vision of Treehouse, and Angela Schultes is the Vice President of Outreach for Treehouse. Angela, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Hi, Bill.
Nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, same. Thanks for having me on.
No, you kidding? I love it. So let's talk about Treehouse, because you guys do amazing work. And it's so necessary to be standing in the gap for troubled teens and teens that are really, they don't know where to turn.
Absolutely.
So tell my listeners more about that, about Treehouse.
Yeah, well, the need is huge. Treehouse has been around for over 30 years serving teens, and as teens have changed, we've continued to do what we can to meet the needs of teens in each day and age that we're working with them. It's a group of people that I personally love dearly, and our staff and our volunteers do as well. And so often they don't know where they fit in their community sometimes, or in the environments that they're in, and they're trying to navigate their way, figure out their identity. And we love to just meet them where they're at, go find them in the spaces that they're in where they might be lonely or disenfranchised, disconnected, maybe too much alone time on their devices and not actually connecting with other peers in healthy ways. And we like to bring them into community in a space of belonging. And we have regular programs for them. Every week we have a support group setting, which is a great referral source for people who are not part of the faith community, where they know that kids from all walks of life are going to come and learn to process their feelings and be heard and know they're not alone in their struggles. And that, you know, every kid is welcome there. And it's just it's an amazing entry point for teens. And as they become part of our program, they get invited into one-to-one mentoring with a safe adult, a volunteer or a paid staff member, who are all trained and equipped to help kids who are dealing with tough, tough issues. We see a lot of emotional struggles, mental illness at times, anxiety, sometimes debilitating anxiety, depression, suicide ideation and attempts. Sometimes kids are just trying to figure out where they belong and don't have a lot of friends, which could lead to some really destructive behaviors over time. Kids with sexual addictions and difficulties, and then sometimes kids who are in the system or in trouble with the law need, you know, additional support coming out of some bad choices that they may have made, and they just need, you know, to learn a new way of relating, a new group of friends, new people to spend time with that can reorient the way they do life. So we just love all teens. We take them all, and we love to create opportunities for them to encounter God, to encounter healthy community, friendships, and just have fun and be teens in healthy, real-life connection ways that maybe aren't happening in other spaces in their life.
Angela, would you say that the kids that come into the program may self-describe themselves as like kids on the margin a little bit out of the circle? Maybe they don't feel like they fit in. Maybe they've come from some physical or sexual abuse, or I mean, there's just about A to Z at Treehouse, isn't there?
You bet. Yeah, there is. Kids will self-describe in all sorts of ways, and we don't limit them to what that might be. When we're talking to people about, you know, who might need our help and our services, you know, we're talking about kids who are looking for extra support through a difficult time, or they're maybe hurting in general, or there's some difficulties in the past. Most teens come with some awareness and willingness to identify about the help they need. Every once in a while, they're just coming in, feet dragging. Grandma said I should come. Not sure really, you know, that they want it. And then once they see what hope they find in that environment, and how, you know, one of the things we prize so highly is authenticity, vulnerability, and we teach kids that. We lead by example as adults in that, and learning that it's okay to struggle and that you can say it out loud and we'll still love you and we're going to help you grow through it. So kids who aren't quite ready yet to say, like, this is my problem or own it, they learn to once they come in our doors a few times.
Mm-hmm. Angela, I always assume that there's some dysfunctionality in every family, but would you say on the whole that most of the kids that gravitate into the program are coming from a slightly more dysfunctional family?
Often, but not always. Sometimes the dysfunction, yeah, I mean, typically. I mean, we get lots of kids who aren't in two-parent homes, kids who are in the foster care system, maybe some kids who've experienced homelessness, you know, just families that are under-resourced in general. But that's maybe, I'd say, about two-thirds of the kids. And other kids are from families that are honest to say, please help us. We're fully engaged. We, you know, we're all in. We're here. And we just have normal struggles, and we want extra support. And I think there's more and more need for that, and would love to see more families in the church and families that know Christ and that maybe are healthy, but have things happening with their teens that are happening in the community or happening at school, social media. I mean, kids from strong families get bullied and don't always know how to talk about what they're going through, or they make a poor choice. They get convinced to do something bad, and then they get stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that freedom and that safety to talk about it can keep them stuck.
Angela, is there a recurring thing you hear from parents where they might say, boy, my son, my daughter, they're feeling more and more isolated, disconnected, they're pulling away a little bit? What do you hear from on a recurring basis?
The most common things are serious anxiety and struggle to cope in social situations, and then self-harm.
Mm.
And then
normal? Yeah. I mean, how frequent is that?
In our realm, it's pretty frequent. It's over 60% of our kids self-report that they have self-harmed. A lot of them, unfortunately, are starting even, you know, even before entering middle school. I mean, we're talking 11, 12-year-olds that have found that coping skill, which is a negative one, but yet it's a coping skill. They do it. It's addictive, but they do it because it works. It helps them manage feelings, just like some of us overeat when we're trying to manage feelings, or we drink alcohol, or we have unhealthy relationships. It's another one of those. And so it's really, and it could be a hard habit to break.
Mm-hmm. Angela, let me take a little break. Angela Schultes is my guest from Treehouse, and they are passionate about helping kids who are at a very challenging phase of life where they don't want anyone to fall through the cracks. They want everyone to come to know Jesus as their Savior and to have a transformation in their life, and they do a great job. I'll take a short break and be back in 90 seconds. Welcome back to the show. It is 17 minutes after the hour. Angela Schultes is my guest. She works in development at Treehouse. Treehouseyouth.org is the website. Fascinating place. Angela, you know, for a lot of adults, when kids start to do scary type behavior, as you talk about self-mutilation and the kinds of things that every parent would be horrified to find out their child was doing. And so they what do adults do? They try to send them somewhere. They say to their youth pastor, "You help." They yell at them. You know, when you get scary behavior at 11 or 12, adult parents and adults don't know how to handle this.
Right. Yeah, I think that's a really big, important point. I'm a parent myself, and I understand that fear is like my worst enemy in how well I parent my children. So as soon as there's something that I'm concerned and nervous about how it's going to go, I over-control, I panic, I might get too emotional in how I communicate, and mm-hmm. that can actually create the opposite effect. And I'd really want to encourage parents that the most important thing you can do, and even for pastors and others who are invested in young people's lives, is they need you to be a safe person for them. They need you to be steady and to not panic, to have that same faith in God for them that you would in other circumstances in your life, even though it might be the scariest thing if they're involved in something dangerous. But they need to know that they can bring their circumstances to you, their behaviors to you, that their reality to you, and that they're still going to be loved unconditionally, and that as they talk it out, that door stays open. And the more you keep that door open and you stay calm and take your fears to the Lord and get, you know, help for yourself to process through it, the better they will do in working through it and allowing you to help them. So I want to really encourage parents to do that and avoid things that might lead to shame or blaming them or you know, saying things like, "That's a stupid thing to do." You know, kids do things for a reason. They're trying to solve a problem that they perceive or a very real problem sometimes in their lives. And they may pick a poor choice in how to do it, but they don't wake up in the morning saying, "How am I going to destroy my life today?"
Mm.
They're saying, "How can I solve this problem that I'm facing today?" So just keep that lens and that mindset for them and have grace for them for what they're trying to navigate and learn.
Yeah, Angela, I love stories. I love always hearing testimonies. And when I hear of a person entering the program and maybe they were self-harming or maybe they had an issue that was not being addressed, do you have some great stories you can share with us?
Yeah,
obviously, no names would be used. Yeah, you can. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we have to respect the privacy of our teens and young people. But let me tell you about a girl. I'll call her Kara, and she came to our program when she was pretty young, referral through a school, and she'd been experiencing abuse at home by her father, who was a drug user, and the behaviors that she chose as a result of coping with the pain and the fear that she faced led counselors, though they didn't know about the abuse, to say, man, you could use some additional help. You know, she was starting to self-harm at, ages 12 and 13. And they referred her to Treehouse, and she found that sense of connection and safety. And over time, through our support groups and mentoring with staff, began to share about what had been happening in her past and what was happening in her family, and allowed us to help her get help navigating those issues and getting into a safe home, figuring those things out. And the big, big thing for her was that she spent years with us letting us teach her about Jesus and the impact that he can have in setting us free in our lives and to forgive and to move through pain to a new space and to learn to cope in new ways. And she's grown tremendously, and she's at a local Christian college here in the Twin Cities now, involved in on-campus ministry, ministering to others. And she's coming back as an intern for us to minister to teens at Treehouse, which is really, really cool to see. You know, that life kind of go through that much of a cycle, and she just has an amazing bright future ahead because she was willing to, you know, to take risks and to engage with the struggles she was having and not run away from those struggles, but face them, you know, every step of the way with us.
I mean,
go ahead.
I just want to add, I would like to, you know, compliment the work that you did at Treehouse helping Kara, because what kid has the language to process pain at 11 or 12?
No.
You don't have the language to process it. So you just live with this horrific pain, and then you start self-medicating or doing whatever it takes to escape the pain. So
exactly.
Nice work.
And even as adults, I mean, I grew up in the church, but, you know, we didn't learn how to talk about our emotions or to be honest with everyone around us about what we're going through and that it's going to be okay, and, to talk through that and get help. And I learned just by being on staff at Treehouse, I learned so much more about naming my emotions and seeing how they were impacting my behaviors. And that's an invaluable skill for all of us. You want me to tell you another story?
Oh, I'd love one, yeah.
Okay, so this is a really different story. And I mean, it's a little bit more on the kind of dramatic or tragic side, but just to give perspective of what some kids are really dealing with. And here in the Twin Cities, I mean, we serve kids mostly in the suburbs. We have some more urban locations, but mostly they're in the suburbs and some well-to-do suburbs. And we have a young man whose story involves, it started pretty young as well, but he lived with his mom, and she would prostitute herself in order to pay rent, you know, just to make money. And when he was a kid, she would bring men into their home, and it was an apartment. And one time she had a man there, and this boy, we'll call him David, was, you know, upstairs, and he heard his mom screaming, and, you know, he'd heard things before, but, whatever the sounds when they ended, he went downstairs, and his mom had been stabbed repeatedly by this person. I mean, I know this is like shocking, but just mm-hmm. perspective of what some kids live through.
Mm-hmm.
And then you wonder why they do the behaviors they do. His mom ended up dying, and then he was, you know, raised by grandparents. And when he came to Treehouse, he was just angry at the world, lashing out. The social worker referred him to us, and he was, you know, failing in school. He was bullying other kids and just really angry and lost. And he tells the story of how over his 3 years at Treehouse, how those walls started to melt down, how he stopped bullying, and he graduated high school, and now he's in college. And he has not made a decision to follow Christ yet, as far as I know, but he went from angry at God and the whole world to and being cruel to other people because of his pain to being open to God and asking the questions and making those steps forward in faith that we believe, of course, will continue. But we journey with these kids through all of that and watch them make progress no matter what, you know, they've been facing. And so that's just another real story of someone who, you know, it's not a pretty perfect picture, but, you know, he's making it, and he's like this, you know, he used to just be so dark and like have the hood over his eyes, and now he smiles and he, you know, makes eye contact, and he's kind, and it's like his true self has really been able to emerge because all those walls have just come melting down.
Yeah, I rejoice at that story. I mean, it's that's tremendous news that he's on a path, and God's got him. You know, it's his story is just unfolding.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
So, yeah, Angela, if there's parents listening and they maybe have got a child that's struggling and they're in that maybe that little bit of a troubled youth phase, what's the best way to reach out to them? Maybe we're not going to send them to a Treehouse facility, but we want to be wise in how we approach kids that are in a really tough time.
Well, I mean, I would love to see parents and families learn and churches in general, the whole faith community, you know, learn more about how to do that, how to see a kid, see struggling behavior, and change first as adults. We have to change our own mindset. I think, honestly, if I'm going to take a couple steps back, it starts with our own self-view. And do we see ourselves as loved? Do we see ourselves as sons and daughters of the King, forgiven, righteous, not striving to earn or measure up? Because if we have the right view of what it means to belong to God through Christ, we can breathe that onto those kids. So when we see those things happen, we can go, what's true about that kid? What's the most true thing about their identity? And not see the behaviors as who they are, but see that as the smoke, right? It's like, oh, where there's smoke, there's fire. It's the smoke. Like, cut through the smoke and ask the Lord, who is this child? Who have you called them out to be? And then call that out in them. Speak life.
That's really encouraging, Angela. I so appreciate your words of not only encouragement, but some of the great testimonies and stories, because that's the way God works in people's
that's
lives.
Right.
You know, he meets them where they're at and works through it in his time. And we need to be patient and loving and put out that welcome mat. And I appreciate what Treehouse does. Treehouseyouth.org is the website of the ministry if you want to go learn more about it. You guys put on spectacular events, by the way, too. So thank you for
thank
what you,
you
do.
Yeah. Yeah. Our pleasure.
All right. Have a great weekend, Angela. And so nice to talk to you and greet your family.
Thanks. Talk to you later, Bill.
You bet. Angela Schultes has been my guest from Treehouse. Great ministry here in the Twin Cities. There should be more like it around the country. Treehouseyouth.org is the website. We'll take a little break, and I've got a lot more to come. We've got Alex McFarland coming up, Hugh Welchel, and it's going to be a great day. Be back in a minute. Welcome back to the show. Always glad to talk to Hugh Welchel from the Faith Work and Economics. Faith Work and Economics Institute. There we go. It's Friday at 3:30. And I want to bring him onto the program. And there are so many questions I have, and he will have the answers because that's what Hugh does for me. Hugh, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah. It's I was out late last night. I was speaking, so I didn't get as much sleep as I normally do. So I apologize for stumbling on Faith, Work, and Economics. I know exactly who you are and exactly what you do at the Institute. So what I really am curious about today is, as God has given us work to do, and there are more Americans working now than ever, which is a good thing, because there's great God designed us to work. But now it seems that there is this new obstacle called the sacred secular divide. You're going to need to tell me what that is and then explain it to me.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It's funny. I go to a lot of Christian colleges and speak, and probably have spoken at, I don't know, a dozen or so in the last year or two. And one of the things I always ask my audience, and I'll ask your audience the same question. I think about what you did yesterday. What percentage of it was secular and what percent was spiritual? And typically what I'll do is I'll go around my classroom and I'll ask people to tell me what they wrote down. And it's interesting, I've never, ever, in all the times I've done this, gotten anyone to say 100% spiritual. Instead, I'll get, you know, 20% spiritual, 80% secular, or other combinations like that. One time, the highest I've ever gotten, one young lady said, I'll give myself 80% spiritual because I did my Bible study in the dorm last night. And what that really points to is this interesting thing that we've kind of developed really over the last 150 years. If you go back farther, it wasn't that that pronounced. But what happens is people think some of the things that they do in their life is secular. And they mean by secular, it's not that they're bad things, but they're things that God just doesn't care about. Whether things like going to church are spiritual and God really cares about them. And then typically what I'll do to these college classrooms that I'm in, I'll say, when Paul says to the Corinthians, whether you eat or drink, do everything to the glory of God, how can you say everything's not spiritual? In fact, if you go back and look in the Old Testament, there's not a Hebrew word for spiritual in that context because they didn't need it. They saw everything as being spiritual. And we as Christians should as well.
Okay, and this is really a fascinating topic. And I love the question you pose the groups and students and the one you've posed the listeners today, because I had to stop and think. Because I've often said in my head, everything I do is spiritual. And so I'm glad to have this discussion. But what is happening with the shift, the secularization of the world, the Christians drifting more into the secular side of society?
Well, I think part of the problem is we have kind of assumed a cultural position that says God's not involved in these types of things. Mm-hmm. I'll give you another perfect illustration. I was on a radio show about a year ago or so, and we were talking about the same idea, and the host was saying, yeah, I get this. This is right. And I said, okay, I'm going to go home tonight, and I'm going to spend about 4.5 hours in a very spiritual endeavor. He says, what's that? And I said, I'm going to go home and watch the NCAA National Championship football game. And there was just silence on the other end, because even though he understood what I was saying about spiritual and secular, he couldn't get his head around how can watching a football game be a secular activity. And a lot of people struggle with that, right? I struggled with it when I first began to think about this. But then if you say everything is spiritual, then everything has to be spiritual. Here's the interesting thing, and this is what happened to me, is I began to struggle through what does that really look like? What does that really mean in my life every day? I had to begin to think about things like watching football. Now, what I told him, and I'll tell your viewers as well, I haven't stopped watching football, particularly college football, because I'm a huge college football fan. But what it's done is made me think about, okay, I understand that God does care about everything I do, including my recreation. He realizes I need some recreation time. I need some downtime from work. But how much do I really need? And I'll be honest with you, as I've kind of thought through this over the last 10 years, I watch a lot less football than I used to, because I begin to realize, yes, it is spiritual, but that doesn't mean I can take advantage of it. And there are other things that, if I look at everything being spiritual, that are more important, not only to God, but should be more important to me. So I think as we begin to think through this, it really begins to help us think through everything we do during a day and begin to think, you know, if everything's spiritual, how should I look at walking the dog? How should I look at doing my taxes? How should I look at all these things we typically put in this secular category? And for God, that secular category doesn't exist. And for us as believers, it shouldn't exist with us either.
Mm-hmm. Hugh, are Christians buying into the definitions of the world more than they used to?
I think so. It's hard to say more than they used to, but you go back and read things, even sermons are written 150 years ago, and they talked about this sort of thing all the time. One of my favorite sermons is by a guy named now it's Friday afternoon. I'm forgetting his name. But,
it's okay. I'm going to give you a pass.
About 150 years ago, Spurgeon is his name. Everybody knows
Charles
Spurgeon.
Yes.
And one of his most famous sermons, he talks about this. And he talks about how there is no separation. In fact, he goes on to say at the end of the sermon, he says, to his mind, you know, separating spiritual from secular is against the very gospel of Jesus Christ. So it's really quite amazing how even Christians 150 years kind of got this, but we've kind of drifted away. And I think there's a good reason for it. It's something we talk a lot about at the Institute called the four-chapter gospel. And we talk about the gospel really should be seen kind of in four chapters: creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. Creation shows the way things were. The fall explains the way things are. Redemption shows the way things could be. And restoration shows the way things are going to be. And if you really look at it that way, it kind of encompasses this whole arch of redemptive history from the first verses in Genesis all the way to the last verses in Revelation. The problem is, in our Christian society today, particularly evangelical Christians today, over the last, once again, and it kind of tracks with the secular spiritual thing, the last 150 years, we've kind of truncated that four-chapter gospel to two chapters. And all we talk about is the fall and redemption. So the gospel becomes all about us. It becomes a gospel of sin management. In some respects, it almost becomes kind of like a bus ticket to heaven. And when we leave off that first chapter, that chapter of creation, we don't really understand what we were created to do. And when we leave off that last chapter, we don't really understand where we're going to end up when all this is said and done. So it's really kind of a shame, because I think that truncating that four-chapter gospel to two chapters and this kind of inwardly focused view of salvation has really distorted our view around these areas of sacred and secular.
You know, Hugh, when you started talking about watching college football, and obviously you can overdo anything, but there's also that idea that there's different keys for different locks. I mean, there's going to be, I know you like old cars and like to restore them, don't you?
Yes, I do.
So let's just say, for example, I have a friend who's not saved, but boy, does he love old cars. And I think I'm going to introduce him to my buddy Hugh, and they're going to sit in a garage and look at an old car and have a conversation. And all of a sudden, your love and passion and hobby of restoring old cars is now an evangelistic tool.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. In fact, it's happened to me more than once.
Oh, I bet it has. And believe me, for every person that likes an old car being restored, there's 100 guys that like football.
That's right. That's exactly right. That's
and,
exactly right.
You know, you can invite them over in front of your 14-inch TV and invite them to come watch football with you.
That's right. That's exactly right. But there's lots of opportunities. But I think we also have to realize that, you know, some of our work is not going to be evangelistic, and that's okay, right? That I often tell people the gospel is a redemptive call to a lost and forfeited calling. And that calling we see in the first chapter of Genesis 1:28, when the world is new, really it's kind of toward the end of the last day of creation, the sixth day of creation. And Adam and Eve have been created. They're in the garden. God comes to them and says, let me tell you why you're here. Let me tell you what your job description is. Let me tell you why I created you and put you here on this earth. And I'm going to argue that what he says to them still applies to us, particularly as believers. And he tells them, you're here for two reasons. One, fill the earth with my images. The second is to subdue the earth. Now, we have to change that a little bit today because of the fall. So we have today, our job today is to first fill the earth with God's redeemed images, right? So that's the church, that's evangelism, that's discipleship. You know, that's all things we've done, you know, a fairly good job. I mean, maybe people might argue about that, but at least we're working at that in the church. The second half, to subdue the earth, one theologian says that word in that context literally means to go make the earth an incredible place for human beings to flourish. That piece we've completely forgot, right? We've kind of pushed that out there and said, oh, our work's just secular. God doesn't care about it. No, our work is intended for us to bring flourishing to God's creation. And I would even go on and say, we say this often at the Institute, that the purpose of your work, no matter what it might be, whether you're running a Fortune 500 company, whether you're a stay-at-home mom, anything in between, the purpose of your work is to bring flourishing to the communities God has called you to serve at that particular time in your life, right? And we often talk about it's just not our vocational work, but also the work we do in our churches, the work we do in our homes, the work we do in our communities. Now, for some of us, that call to family, for example, stay-at-home mom again, her call to family kind of overlaps with her call to vocation or a pastor. His call to the church overlaps his call to the vocation. But for most of us, it's going to sort out into four separate buckets. And as we go through our lives, we're going to work in those four areas, paid and unpaid. But all that work, is the purpose of it, is to bring flourishing to those God has called us to serve. Once we begin to understand that principle, then it really begins to breathe a new life into every single thing we do, whether it's evangelical or not. So a guy sitting in front of a computer working on a spreadsheet, if he realizes he needs to do that to the glory of God, you know, no one may even get saved, but something he does gets connected with something else someone else does, and somehow all that brings flourishing. I'll tell you a story. I did a conference in Missoula, Montana, one of the most beautiful places on the face of the earth, and spoke on like a Friday night and Saturday morning. Then I preached at one of the churches on Sunday morning. This guy came up to me. He said, look, he said, I've listened to your conference. He says, you need to know I'm 55 years old. I wash dishes for a living. I became a Christian about 10 years ago. And I thought the only thing I could do was occasionally witness to my faith once in a while. He says, but I'm way in the back where it's hot and steamy. He says, no one comes back there. But he said, if what you're saying is true, and I assured him it was, he says, every dish I wash, if I do it to the glory of God, somehow in ways I don't completely understand, that work connects with someone else's work, and that other person's work connects with someone else's work, and together we bring flourishing to the community. And tears are running down his eyes. And I said, that's right. He said, that makes all the difference. And that's what we're trying to do at the Institute, is try to make people connect the dots and realize the purpose of their work, paid and unpaid, is to bring flourishing to God's creation. And literally, we're to bring flourishing to some people who were never voluntarily bowing knee to Jesus Christ, but they're still part of his creation, and we should serve them to see that they flourish.
I love it, Hugh. I'm always a little troubled when somebody tells me what their job is, and before they tell me what their job is, they put in the words, I'm just a.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There's no just a.
There's no just a.
Exactly, yeah. Right.
All right. Hugh Welchel is my guest. We're going to take a little break and be back with more in just a minute. Hugh Welchel is my guest. He is the executive director for the Institute for Faith, Work, and Economics. And Hugh, here's a question. What about the purpose of your life? What does the purpose of your life at work tell other people? That's kind of a loaded question.
No, it's a great question, though. That's a great question. And I think if you go back to that four-chapter gospel I was talking about, you know, we said the first chapter of creation is about the way things are. The second chapter of the fall is about – excuse me, the second chapter is about the way things are. The third chapter is about the way things could be. And I often tell people the story. When Jesus healed the blind man, or when he fed the 5,000, you know, what was he doing really? Could Jesus have fed everyone that was hungry in Israel? Sure he could have. Did he? No. Could he have healed everyone that was sick and blind? Of course he could. He was the Son of God. He could do anything he wanted, but he didn't. And if you ask that question, you know, or you think about that, and you really ask us, well, why didn't he? I have a theologian named Art Lindsley who has a PhD in theology at my works for the Institute. He would tell you, well, Jesus was demonstrating his power and authority as the Son of God, and all that's true. But I think there's another point that's very important and really kind of speaks to your question. And I would argue that when Jesus healed the blind man, he was showing them there could be a time when no one's blind. When he feeds the 5,000, he's showing them there could be a time when no one's hungry. And in a sense, because he's living in the third chapter, this chapter of redemption, and the idea is to show people the way things could be, he's showing them the way things could be. And we as disciples do likewise. We're to go out and do things to bring flourishing to the people that we're called to serve, to give them a glimpse of the way things could be, and really be a signpost pointing toward that last chapter of restoration that is going to be the way things are going to be forever, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we do our work, we should do an excellent job. We should do everything we do with the level of excellence. Paul also tells in one of his letters that, you know, to remember that we're not working for the guy in the corner office, right? We answer to a higher calling. We answer we work for the guys in the ultimate upper office, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's who we serve. And once, I mean, it's hard to remember that because we get so bogged down and work is so hard. Somebody told me the other day, they said, well, Hugh, you know, work is part of the fall. It can't be good. I said, no, work was created. It was ordained before the fall. The fact that work is hard is part of the fall. So we work under the curse and we know work's going to be hard. But when we get to the new heaven and new earth and live with Jesus forever, there'll be work, right?
Mm-hmm.
I tell people about this. Think about a day when you were working and everything went perfect, right? I mean, you were just on, just everything clicked, you know, and what God's doing, he's giving you a glimpse of the way things are going to be. Because every day, every minute, you know, every hour, every day, every week for eternity, when you work in the new heaven and new earth, it's going to be better than those few minutes where everything went just perfect. And that's worth looking forward to because we sometimes, and we're supposed to feel a joy and a satisfaction in the work we do, even here now, even though it's not perfect and it's flawed and we work in this fallen world and it's difficult. Every now and then, God gives us a glimpse, right, of the joy that's in serving him. And we need to understand that that's true about everything. One of my favorite movies of all time is The Chariots of Fire. And there's a great quote in that movie. There's some guys training for the 1924 Olympics. They're runners. And this one young man who's running is talking to his sister. And he says, when I run, I feel God's pleasure. And for him, at that point in his life, his calling was to run, and he trained, right, you know, getting ready for the Olympics. But I think that should be true for all of us, and not that it's going to happen all the time, once again, because work is difficult because of the curse.
Mm-hmm.
But once in a while, and you should expect this, once in a while for God to give you a glimpse of that feeling that, you know, this is right. This is what I was made to do. It says very clearly in Genesis, in the second chapter of Genesis, that God made Adam and put him into the garden to work it and to take care of it. We were made to work. And it's the only place we're truly going to find a sense of satisfaction and a sense of purpose in this world when we're doing our work, understanding it is what God's called us to do.
Hugh, I love the word flourishing. I know you use it often, and the people around the Institute love it, and I think it's a fantastic word. I'm just trying to connect the dots as to what it looks and feels like to someone who's listening right now. Would they say, my life is flourishing, or what is the standard? What gives us the idea that we understand what flourishing means? I'm flourishing when? Fill in the blank.
Yeah, no, that's a really, really good question, because flourishing is a relative thing in this fallen world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue you're flourishing when you're doing the things that God's called you to do, and you're doing them the best that you possibly can, and the work that you're doing is blessing other people.
Okay.
You know, and the part of the problem in our current, you know, world and the way most of us work, and this is really true for me, I have a big yard. You know, I have a couple acre yard, and one of the things I love to do is mow it. And that sounds so strange. In fact, you know, spring is here. I can't wait for the grass to grow. because one of the few things that I do in my life, when I get finished, I look back and it's done. Mm-hmm. And it looks good. It looked bad before. It looked good. Because most of the things in my life, in my business, take so long. And you work at things for a really long time without really seeing a finished product. Sometimes you never see the finished product, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, and that is one of the things that a lot of people struggle to kind of understand, this idea of flourishing. But see, here's the thing. And this is what people don't understand. There's a fascinating passage. It's part of a letter that the prophet Jeremiah sends to the exiles in Babylon. And in this letter, it's Jeremiah 29:7. It is an incredible verse. And in that, he talks about how these people should live. Now, they're in the city of Babylon. And the city of Babylon is trying to assimilate them into the Babylonian culture. I mean, that's the way the king Nebuchadnezzar had it set up. They weren't made slaves, but they were to go down and be assimilated into the culture. And what Jeremiah is telling them is that they're to go down and work for the peace and prosperity of the city. Literally, he's telling them, go work for the flourishing of the city, because if it flourishes, you too will flourish. Listen, I think this is one of the most powerful passages in the whole Old Testament for Christians today, because if you really want to flourish, the only way you're going to do it is go see that other people flourish.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we say, well, that's so counterintuitive, but the gospel is always counterintuitive, right?
Yeah.
So if you want to flourish, you got to go out and work and do things to bring flourishing to other people. And that's when you'll know that you're flourishing. Now, let me say one other thing real quick before we run out of time. One of the problems, and you alluded to this, a lot of people are using the word flourishing, Christians and non-Christians alike, but it's kind of a, it's almost, it seemed like in the last 3 or 4 years, it's become a very popular buzzword. So how do you tell the difference between cultural flourishing and biblical flourishing? Very, very important point. And once again, I want to take you back to a story in Genesis. There's a story in Genesis about a group of people get together and say, let's build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens. And they say this, and they know why they're going to do it, because they say in the next passage, they say, so that we might make a name for ourselves. And that's just an incredible passage, because it doesn't go well for them. It doesn't really work out too well. And this is the story about the Tower of Babel. And I would invite people to go back and read it. But the reason it doesn't work out well is because they're trying to bring about flourishing to glorify themselves.
Mm-hmm.
True biblical flourishing doesn't glorify us. It glorifies God. And that's the piece you always have to keep in mind. Are you working to the glory of God? Or are you working to make a name for yourself? Listen, I live in Washington, D.C. People come to the city to make a name for themselves. And many are destroyed because of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
As believers, we have to really clearly understand that difference. I believe that's why that story is there, mm-hmm. to give us an incredible illustration of what it looks like and what happens to you if your prime desire. See, there's nothing wrong with building a city. There's nothing wrong with building a tower that reaches to the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
It's all about motivation. It's about why are you doing it, which really gets back to what we tell people. You know, the why of your work, the purpose of your work, the thing, and that will keep you going even when things get tough, if you know the why, is to bring flourishing to God's creation.
Yeah. Hugh, thank you so much for coming on to the show. And I do feel sorry for people who just want to make a name for themselves. Thank you for joining on Afternoons with Bill Arnold. It's been great having you on the show.
Thank you.
You bet, Hugh. Hugh also has been my guest, Executive Director of the Faith Institute, FaithWorks and Institute. We'll take a little break and be back with more in just a minute. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.